poetry has always been for me the escape. It's always been the way that I can say what I really want to say in the midst of all the mess of the world.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with poet and National Book Award finalist Jericho Brown about his collection, The Tradition.
Ultimately, the book is in many ways about the normalization of evil, why we are putting up with a world in which awful things are happening, and why we are allowing these awful things to happen as if they are normal. For instance, mass shootings now barely make the news. For instance, the fact of Black families having conversations with their little boys and their little girls about how to interact with police in ways that other families don't have to have conversations. For instance, even on the level of the way we think about sex and sexuality.
Upturning Traditions Through Poetry and Jericho Brown on Arts and Letters.
Why can't we face the reality of ourselves as complex beings? That's what our poems do for us. Our poems remind us that we are complex beings.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Menick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be discussing various traditions with poet Jericho Brown, whose work unravels tropes, looks directly at race and violence, poses riddles, and metatextually examines traditions of poetry and the poet.
There's a way that the book is really trafficking in several traditions at once is what I really want. And one of those traditions, it is the tradition of literature and Black literature in particular, and the contribution that Black literature has literally made to the progression of our culture. Many of these poems are quite obviously, quite simply, pastoral poems.
Jericho Brown, director of the Creative Writing Program at Emory University, and
a poet.
And a poet.
That's what I really am, right?
It is.
More than anything else. The only reason I get to do anything else I get to do is because I'm a poet. Isn't that something?
It is.
I'm here today because I'm a poet.
Welcome to Arts and Letters.
So much history here. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Brad. I'm glad people still let me come on the radio in public.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm really glad about that. It makes me very happy.
Were there moments where they...
I worry sometimes.
Where they might have been hesitant?
I'm glad you chose to take a risk. Anything could happen.
So tell us a little bit about this book. I know it's your third.
My first book is called Please, and my second book is titled The New Testament. And my mother's still mad at me about that title. And this book is called The Tradition. I'm very proud of it. You know, she's an Aries like me. So in the entire time I was making her, it was a war. But we get along just fine now. I understand her a lot better. She understands me. We're good. Now that she's out in the world, we're good.
So how have you come to understand each other?
Well, I came to understand her by way of understanding that she was going to have need of me that I hadn't given to my poems before. When I was writing this book, I really felt as if I was somehow possessed, to be quite honest with you. I was afraid. I was scared to write these poems in the way they got written. Most of them were written between Thanksgiving of 2017 and Martin Luther King Day of 2018. Pages and pages and pages of poetry that I could not stop from coming to me. But because I'm a poet, because I want to answer the call of the poem, I kept writing them. I kept pulling my car over to write them. I kept getting up in the middle of the night to write them. I kept staying up late to write them. And I had a brand new job, which required me being at meetings at 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, being, you know, very professional. You understand what I mean? But I was up late working on this book. Before I went into this book, I had a kernel of about 20 pages of poetry. And then suddenly, I probably wrote in that very short period something like 60 pages of poetry.
What do you think sparked that?
I was trying to escape that new job. I find that the more intense my life is, that really has nothing to do with poetry, the more I'm dealing with a kind of work. I noticed this even when I was in graduate school, studying to get my PhD, when it was time to do finals, that's when I really wanted to write poetry. So poetry always, when my mother was very ill, she had had a stroke, and I was sitting up with her and I was dealing with the emotional stress of that moment, driving back and forth between Houston, Texas and Shreveport. I was driving the car wishing I could write poetry.
So I hesitate to ask this, but help me with the sense of the mother.
The mother in this book is definitely built for my mother, and I'm very proud of these poems where my mother appears. Hero. She never knew one of us from another, so my brothers and I grew up fighting over our mother's mind, like sun-colored suitors in a Greek myth. We were willing to do evil. We kept chocolate around our mouths. The last of her mother's lot, she cried at funerals, cried when she whipped me daily.
This mother is the hero of this book, I think.
Well, she really opens much of this book, and I wanted to write my mother the way I really think of my mother. And my mother is a powerful woman, capable of love and tenderness and acting absolute crazy and violence and strength and deep singing sadness. You know, my mom would sing you to tears. I am most interested in people who declare gratitude for their childhood beatings. None of them took what my mother gave, waking us for school with sharp slaps to our bare thighs.
Yeah, the tough one was the slapping on the legs in the morning when you get
which
up.
Is little, man. That's really my mom. My mom was ready for us to go to school, and she would come in our rooms, and the first step, and you know it would be cold, the first step was, it's time to get up. That was it. And then she would go back out. And the next step was coming back in the room, and she would take all the sheets on the bed and throw them off of the bed. So you would be left there just in the air, you know? And then the next step was, okay, I'm coming for them thighs.
Oh, man.
And she would get to slapping your thigh. You get out the bed.
Oh, man.
Yeah, she was, she's something, my mom's something else. That side of the family is darker. I should be grateful, so I will be. No one on earth knows how many abortions happened before a woman risked her freedom by giving that risk a name, by taking it to breast.
Before a woman risked her freedom by giving that risk a name.
Yeah. Somebody went through the trouble. My mama went through the trouble, you know, and she did it every day. So I want to honor that, you know. I don't know why I am alive now, that I still cannot impress the woman who whipped me into being. I turned my mother into a grandmother. She thanks me by kissing my sons. Gratitude is black. Black as a hero returning from war to a country that banked on his death. Thank God, it can't get much darker than that.
Help me with dark and light in this.
Yeah, so I'm sort of interested in that throughout the book, ways that I could use the word dark. Many of these poems that are about race are also, I would like to think, to Black people. And I think among Black people, we think a lot about which of us is dark and which of us is light, or light-skinned, as they used to say where I'm from, or bright-skinned. It's hilarious. And so, you know, those are the kinds of things that I was interested in. I was interested in the way that dark has other kinds of connotations, as well as the color of skin. It also has these connotations of tone and feeling and style. And even the word dark can connote beauty. And so I'm trying to use that word at various points throughout the book in different ways to sort of point to risk, ultimately. What is the risk of freedom? What is the risk of knowledge? What is the risk of really looking at your family, really looking at your country? What is the risk of looking at who you are as a brother or a sister? What to be that? Literal about that is dark, and you've got to deal with it. Bullet points. I will not shoot myself in the head, and I will not shoot myself in the back, and I will not hang myself with a trash bag. And if I do, I promise you, I will not do it in a police car while handcuffed or in the jail cell of a town I only know the name of, because I have to drive through it to get home. Yes, I may be at risk, but I promise you, I trust the maggots who live beneath the floorboards of my house to do what they must to any carcass more than I trust an officer of the law of the land to shut my eyes like a man of God might, or to cover me with a sheet so clean my mother could have used it to tuck me in. When I kill me, I will do it the same way most Americans do. I promise you. Cigarette smoke, or a piece of meat on which I choke, or so broke I freeze in one of these winters we keep calling worst. I promise if you hear of me dead anywhere near a cop, then that cop killed me. He took me from us and left my body, which is, no matter what we've been taught, greater than the settlement a city can pay a mother to stop crying, and more beautiful than the new bullet fished from the folds of my brain.
I can see them. Keep them in the air like you're trying to touch the ceiling. I usually tell the crowd this when I'm in coliseums, but for unfortunate reasons, it took on another meaning. Reasons so horrific that I struggle to believe them. Reasons that so many of my people out here grieving. Reasons that Americans don't want to pledge allegiance to a nation with police that kill my people for no reason. What if it was me? Staring down the barrel of a Smith & Wesson M&P with 9 lives left in the clip. On my way to heaven, but after a hell of a trip, I don't know what I would do. I don't know what I would say. I mean, really, could I actually make him put the gun away? If he doesn't, should I stay or should I try to run away? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. But I do know who I am. I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a law-abiding man. I'm the one who sees you struggling, so I'll provide a hand. And the one who tries to help the people any way I can. I try to get to know the people I don't understand. I'm begging you, drop the gun, I'll honor your demands. I got a wife and kids, and all of them depend on me coming home. Look, I'm doing nothing wrong. Look, my hands up, right where you can see them. I got them in the air like I'm trying to touch the ceiling. I got folks who love me, and I don't want to leave them. So please, put the gun down. Put the gun down. Put the gun down.
It's interesting that there is this collective disbelief about the possibility that Black people get mistreated by police for absolutely no reason. And yet, all Black people have been saying it forever. Then when we get video of it, to this very day,
after seeing murder after murder after murder, we still can't get an indictment?
Let's continue our conversation with poet Jericho Brown about his book, The Tradition. I do want to talk briefly about language. And second language really worked for me. The nature of story. What is the story?
Mm-hmm.
Why do words undo one's tongue?
Second language. You come with a little black string tied around your tongue, knotted to remind where you came from and why you left behind photographs of people whose names now buck pronouncing. How do you say God now that the night rises sooner? Why must we wake to work before any alarm? I am the man asking.
Can you help us with, this is a second language.
Yeah.
It's not the first language.
Well, I was thinking about the margins and the people who are on the outside of them and what they have in common, and how often those of us who have what we think of as the least are pitted against one another. And yet, if we could find some way to come together, and when we do find ways to come together, we make the difference that leads to progression of culture in this country. My grandfather, who knows how, why, or where he got the idea, he sent 8 of his 13 children to college. He figured out how to get out of the sharecropping system and how to send his children to college. This is somebody who was thinking about the possibility of someone like me before I could even exist. I couldn't exist when my mom was a baby girl. I couldn't have existed in the 40s. I only get to exist now because of what happened in the 40s or the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. So this is a poem that means to find unity, I think, among people who have so much of that kind of a past of oppression in common. The great-grandson made so by the dead tenant farmers promised a plot of woods to hew. They thought they could own the dirt they were bound to. In that part of the country, a knot is something you get after getting knocked down. And story means lie. The other thing that happens in this poem that I should say is it harkens back to something that I've noticed that is very present tense. And many people from the South will have had this experience. I don't know if others who are not from the South would have had the same experience. But when I was growing up, the word lie was a cuss word. You could not say lie in front of grown people or you would get knocked across a room. You couldn't say that anyone had lied, even if they had lied. But here's what you really couldn't do. You couldn't call a person a liar. It's interesting to me that a lot of lynchings, a lot of violence that was perpetrated during and after slavery happened to people based on lies and happened to people based on this question. Are you calling me a liar? This is literally a question that people would be asked right before some violence happened to them. To deny what someone is accusing you of, mm-hmm. even if you haven't done it, means that you are calling them a liar. And when somebody says to you, are you calling me a liar? You can get ready for the violence to occur. In your plot of the country, class means school. This room where we practice words that undo your tongue when you tell a lie or start a promise or unravel like a story. When I was growing up, you couldn't say lie. Instead, you had to say story. You had to say, and not only
you're
that.
You're telling stories.
You've heard this before.
Of course.
people would go so far not to say lie that you would hear sentences like, you can tell I'm a poet because I get excited just about the fact of the sound of a sentence, but you could hear sentences like, she's storying on me. Why y'all storying? That's a story. You just telling stories. You came here with that old story. Because nobody would say lie. And so part of what I'm saying is, whether you're telling a lie or starting a promise or losing the memories that could only be remembered in your language, now you're translating memories, which means even the stories of your past will change. That something about that is indeed a loss. And that we carry that loss together, which I think is what's most important to me about the poem. That it's something that I lose too. Like, the more I learn about this language, the more I myself become obsessed with this language, then I also have to retrieve a language from my past, which is why I'm very careful to use certain kinds of words in these poems, like story. And part of what I have to do as a poet is I have to lift that vernacular to the same level as this mythologized idea of colonial English. That's my job. That's the way I get the stories I've been told. And that's how they have to be told. I have to honor those stories.
We're talking with poet Jericho Brown. Let's conclude our discussion of his book, The Tradition. Let's read after another country.
Yeah, sure.
So the literary tradition here is you're invoking, but you're also invoking the American tradition that isn't necessarily what we think it is.
Yeah. After another country. Some dark of us dark, the ones like me, walk around looking for a building or a bridge. We mumble and pull at our lips, convinced until we see how far down the distance we arrive to leave, calling ourselves cowards. But not you, Rufus. You make it to the George Washington, bold as an officer of the law with the right to direct traffic when all the stoplights are out, and you leap dirty against the whiteness of the sky to your escape through the whiteness of the water.
Was it after reading Baldwin?
Yeah. One of the lines in the poem literally says, we arrive to leave calling ourselves cowards, but not you, Rufus, which is like the character from Baldwin who commits suicide. And it's one of the things that I was thinking about dealing with race in the book in the way that I do, and dealing with whiteness and blackness and whatever they are and may mean.
To invoke Baldwin, you better be good.
You know, I think it's always important for me when I think about tradition, you know, I'm naming my own. And Baldwin, any way you look at it, is a forefather. Sure. And he's somebody that in order to do what I do, I have to be aware of and I have to consider. He goes into everything that comes out of me. And at the same time, I have to somehow find my own individual voice in the midst of all of that.
I kind of like riddle because I think it does take us through the entire gamut of emotions. Mm-hmm. And we got to know our history on this one.
When I was a kid, I loved riddles. You know, everybody gets to be like their own special kind of nerd. You could be a video game nerd. You could be a comic book nerd. You know, all those nerds are expensive nerds to be. So I was a riddle nerd. Riddle. We do not recognize the body of Emmett Till. We do not know the boy's name nor the sound of his mother wailing. We have never heard a mother wailing. We do not know the history of this nation in ourselves. We do not know the history of ourselves on this planet because we do not have to know what we believe we own. We believe we own your bodies but have no use for your tears. We destroy the body that refuses use. We use maps we did not draw. We see a sea, so cross it. We see a moon, so land there. We love land so long as we can take it. Shh, we can't take that sound. What is a mother wailing? We do not recognize music until we can sell it. Shh, we sell what cannot be bought. We buy silence. Shh. Let us help you. How much does it cost to hold your breath underwater? Wait, wait. What are we? What? What on earth are we? What?
What are we?
I don't know. I really don't know.
It's in three parts.
Yeah, the book is in three parts.
And I really did see distinctions between.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The first part seems to be about childhood.
Yeah.
The second part, often commentaries on culture.
Yeah.
And then the third part is on sexuality, violence.
Yeah, it's love phones. There's so many love. See, this is the thing. Y'all are going to see this, and we spend so much time, and it is true that I am a poet of the moment and a poet that ends up with poems that are social and political in many ways. But, you know, if you read the three books of Jericho Brown, you are going to come across some love poems. I am a poet of Eros. Let's not forget, Cupid is in the building. There will always be in a Jericho Brown book people making love. Make sure you get that on the podcast. Get that on the radio show. And the reason why that's going to be in every book is because that's an important part of my life. And I believe that it is an important part of yours.
This last part was intense because these are a variety of love poems to things we may not want to love in some ways and things we do.
I think I can read Dark.
And it's nice because it's so self-referential, too.
Yeah, and I think it's hilarious.
It's the one time you mention your own name.
Yeah, I like that. Isn't that something? I'm real pro-smart. Dark. I am sick of your sadness, Jericho Brown. Your blackness, your books. Sick of you laying me down so I forget how sick I am. I'm sick of your good looks, your debates, your concern. I'm sick of you saying no when yes is as easy as a young man. Bored with you saying yes to every request, though you're as tired as anyone else yet, consumed with a single diagnosis of health.
And it's funny, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. Yeah,
but it's not, too.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not. I'm sick of your hurting. I see that you're blue. You may be ugly, but that ain't new.
It does have the self-referential moment. So yeah, the Jericho Brown is you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is me.
This is you.
The one and only.
Right.
And I am sick of your sadness, Jericho Brown. Everyone you know is just as cracked. Everyone you love is as dark, or at least as black.
Is this looking at oneself as oneself sees oneself, or is this looking at oneself as another person sees you?
It's sort of looking at myself as if I'm another person.
So it is, I'm sick of you,
yeah.
Jericho.
I, Jericho Brown,
am sick of you, Jericho Brown. But you can't escape yourself.
This is what escape is in poetry and actuality. You're taking all of the mess of the world, and sometimes the mess of the world is the good stuff too, but you're taking all of the mess of the world and you're trying to push it outside of yourself and deal with it as if it is clay and make something of it. But it's still the mess of the damn world. It's literally you trying to deal with and put in order all the stuff that you have not been able to deal with and put in order every day.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to musicians and songwriters Earl Watson Jr., Tim Anthony. A special thanks to Cook, who supplied an original song for this episode, inspired by Jericho Brown's poem, Bullet Points. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to poet Jericho Brown for combining, conflating, and contrasting traditions
and turning the mess of the world into something that sings. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of James Baldwin. If you know whence you came, there are absolutely no limitations to where you can go.